Welcome to the USPSA podcast. We'll be discussing USPSA, Steel Challenge, and Multigun. We'll be going behind the scenes to talk to area directors about USPSA board procedures and policies, what's in the minutes from the board meetings, and the discussions behind them. The current USPSA bylaws and the minutes can be found at USPSA.org/BOD_minutes and USPSA.org/bylaws. Additional information about USPSA, Steel Challenge, the rules, how to join, announcements, and where to find clubs can also be found at USPSA.org and SCSA.org, and on mobile apps available from app stores.
All right, this is Jake Martins, Director of Meeting and Events, and I am back with another podcast on the USPSA podcast, and I have a special guest. Today, I have Mr. J.J. Ricazza, who is joining us. J.J., how are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me, Jake. It's awesome to be here. It's awesome to be on the USPSA podcast.
The podcast started out to where we were going to talk to the board of directors about all the fun stuff that they had going on, and that got kind of boring for me really quick. So I had Shannon on. I've had Jason Spradling from Federal, and you and I had talked about doing this before Christmas after I went and visited the Beretta facility there in Tennessee. And this was able to kind of work into your schedule because I know that you are full-time stay-at-home dad, part-time professional shooter, I think is what, or Instagram influencer. I don't know which, I don't know where the role falls in there, but I mean, I know that your schedule is that you were doing training this morning and you had a nice window of opportunity for us to meet before your kids get home from school.
Yes.
And before you head off to Puerto Rico for the Caribbean Open.
Yes, sir.
All right. So how long have you been playing this game?
Since 1988 in the Philippines and 1993, I moved to the U.S. and we had a 6-year layoff, 93 to 99, then resumed 99 and haven't stopped since. So in the U.S. alone, about 23 years.
And in that time, you really were a professional law enforcement trainer up until 2015?
Yes. I still train a lot of law enforcement, but in regards to who I work for, I either work for a contracting company or work for DHS. When I was in Department of Homeland Security in 2006, I was a field agent for about 3 years, and then I became a ground-based assignment guy where I was either a lead firearms instructor or an academy instructor or training officer and just kept trying to move the ranks.
And you were with DHS up until you essentially kind of retired from that and then went into, I guess, what we would refer to as full-time professional trainer, professional shooter.
Yes, which is crazy. Yeah.
Right.
Because it's
happening. I mean, and I think, right. So I think most people would sit there and say that you've been a professional shooter the entire time. But realistically, that's really more just here recently. And you would probably consider yourself more of a professional trainer than you would pro shooter, right?
Yes, 100%. And that's a big misconception a lot of times. People are like, oh, you've been a pro for so long. I'm like, man, I really wasn't. Like, I wasn't even really sponsored. I was getting free things, but I wasn't really sponsored. Right now I'm making a living out of it, and this is actually my full-time job.
Right. And you have been sponsored by several different companies at different times. Probably most notably, you were LimCat was probably your big custom gun builder for a very long time.
Right. He started me out at 2000. It was right after 99. I went to go shoot the World Shoot just because it was in Cebu and that was where I came from. So they invited me back to shoot it because they knew my history there. And then I met LimCat there, Johnny, and he's like, man, I really like this kid. He seems like a nice kid, right? It seems like he wants to shoot. And so he's like, hey, when you get to the U.S., contact me. And I didn't even know what contacting means. And I remember it had to be a long distance call from New Jersey from my landline to his office in Reno, Nevada. And my dad was like, this better be an important phone call.
So I'm glad you brought up your dad. He's actually the one who got you into shooting. But it's because he was actually in the Philippines, was already participating in IPSC matches there on a regular basis.
Yes, he was. So there was a necessity for having a gun in the Philippines. And then the second part of it was when he went to the range, he had a get an opportunity or a chance meeting with some folks running and gunning through a house. And when he saw that, he said, hey, I want to learn how to shoot and through windows and doors and clear rooms. And they told him, this is not a tactics thing. This is a competition that we're doing. You need to show up to the match and start learning this thing. And so he started doing it for a while, a year or two, and then he started bringing home some real legitimate trophies where he would leave for the weekend and travel out, come back with trophies. And I'm like, Dad, what is all this? And at that time, I was just martial arts, right? Like karate and taekwondo. And I was like, I didn't really feel the passion and getting my ass beat, right? Sorry for that word, to go compete in that. And shooting seemed to be a lot more fun, and they were traveling to places. And so, yeah, he was like, hey, well, if you can outdraw me, he goes, I'll take you to the range. And that was, I'll never forget that. And I was like, how do I do that? He's like, take this holster, take this belt, take this gun, and dry fire upstairs like I do. So I watched him dry fire one point, and I just kept putting it on, and I dry fired for about 6 months. And I finally said, I think I'm comfortable enough to say that I can probably beat you in regards to speed. And it didn't start to happen. That was 1988.
And that was, so right there in 1988. But your dad was holding his own there, traveling around to IPSC matches, and I think was not only your first real coach, but a guy that you heavily leaned on for the technical side of what you learned, right?
Right. And at that time, right, there was everything was trial and error. There was no YouTube, there was no videos. We had a 30-second clip of Rob Latham shooting poppers coming out of a helicopter. And I remember he was shooting tracer rounds, and like, man, that guy knows what he's doing because he's on TV. So I want to look like that. And my dad mirrored his stance like that. And somewhere along the line of that, I started out with my elbows locked and all those techniques, like the old school techniques. And then eventually I ran into somebody, and it's like, hey, my dad actually was like, hey, we need to learn how to bend that elbow and absorb that technique. Because I think this other guy here, he's a pretty good shooter. He's also, at that time, his name was Jerry Soon, my dad's good friend. He said, hey, he's shooting with a bent elbow technique. And I think the gun seems to be flatter, and that might be good for you. And so I remember he bent my elbow the first time from being in this position forever, bent it after a year. And my first shot, I swear to you, I thought the gun hit my forehead, right? 'Cause it rocked me back. We were shooting 45. That was the only option at that point also. So yeah, but in regards to coach training, my dad is it. He's been it most of my life. He's still it till today. He's a consistent throughout my entire shooting. I've grown and developed my own style throughout, but my dad is the one that can always tell when something's wrong. I always say that he was never the best coach, but he was always the greatest identifier of problems. He's like, hey, that's not a good technique. We need to fix that. And I don't know how to fix that, but we'll figure it out together. And, you know, like I said, in the beginning, it was all trial and error. And he was a hard coach. It was not, it was not fun going to the range a lot of times.
Well, I still see him off kind of on the sidelines at matches and at nationals and stuff where you may have a difficult stage and his demeanor, it doesn't change, but the look on his face with you, it's almost kind of like telepathy or just kind of a mental look as like, you know what you did wrong. I don't have to tell you anything. And he'll just kind of stand off to the side and see that. And I've watched that interaction, which is, you know, it's pretty cool that you have that, you know, support group that's been there with you for this past 22, 23 plus years.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's more of an awesome feeling now, like an honor to see him come with me to these matches as of late, now that he's got a lot more time. We used to do it a lot in the beginning because, you know, he was my number one sponsor, right? So he would travel and drive me all to places and find all these matches. And then when I started to really explore all the other, my world, basically, in the Department of Homeland Security, I started traveling by myself. And then I moved different spots, whatever they decided, what office they decided to have me. And I started to do those things by myself, really, for a while. And it felt weird not having him. And then, you know, at the same time, you get used to it and you're like, oh, this is kind of nice to have this freedom. And then at the same time, when you start, there's certain things that usually you start looking for your support system when you run into a rough spot, right? Like when I get to a sticky point in a match, and I'm like, man, I wish my dad was here. I would just want to clear my head up. Like, give me something, give me some guidance. And sometimes I would literally physically call him on the phone like, dad, hey, this is what I'm looking at. What do you think I should do? And whether it's like profounding what he says or the most basic thing, he's like, do your what you feel in your gut. It makes me feel good and comfort. So there's that comfort level there, right? That is just between him and I, not against me, against the world or against the super squad or whatever. So it's pretty nice to have him around.
Well, he's also, you talk about the guys that are on the super squad that you shoot with. It's usually kind of the same group of guys. It changes up a little bit. You've seen a lot more younger faces kind of come onto that squad here in the last couple of years, especially in open division as things have kind of changed up. But I've seen him over there coaching Max, you know, Travis, and, you know, kind of giving pats on the back and little things like that, because he, like I said, he's been a staple there at the matches with you, and those guys all know him and kind of lean on that as well. So it's even kind of comforting for me to see him over there, like where it's almost, hey, you know, did you approve of this stage over here? Was it okay? You know, 'cause I'm looking at it from a little different perspective. So yeah, that was a good stage. All right. So I'm good.
Yeah, he's a man of few words, right? And then a lot of times he tends to forget where he is. He tends to just focus on his own world, and he's in his own world. And Max is someone that we've been around for so long. Travis, Mike Seeklander, like we grew up shooting together. Casey, so he'll, like when something happens to Max or something he struggle, he'll have no problems just walking to Max and be like, hey Max, you okay? Everything good? He goes, all right, man, keep it up. And I look at him like that. Don't give him a pep talk. I'm going against him right now.
I don't know if you know this. I don't know if you know this. We're 14 points apart. So let's talk a little bit about the training that you and the job that you were doing with DHS, and kind of because I know that as a full-time trainer that now it's probably what? 70% still kind of law enforcement versus the competition side, that you're probably doing more departments or being requested for that.
So it's weird. So for my lifetime, right, since 2002, I started, it was all law enforcement, military training. Like it was contracting. It was all law enforcement and some military. I got to work with them. And then when I jumped into the Department of Homeland Security, it was all law enforcement, 100% law enforcement. There were some times there would be kind of like a joint task where you would train with other folks and military, where international folks will come here, the Cobra guys from Austria and Australia and Germany, and a couple of these other high-end guys, highly trained guys. And those were like some of the exposures. When I left the Department of Homeland Security in 2015, my initial training, I could tell you, it was like about 90% civilian and competition. And then it was like 10% law enforcement, right? Maybe 1% military. And then through the years, even though it's only been 8 years per se, 7 years per se, throughout those 7-8 years, it's transitioned now more to where I'm, this year alone, I looked at my schedule. My wife was just doing it. It's like 60-70% law enforcement, military. And then there's about 30% civilian. And it's, you know, the harder thing is there's still a whole lot more civilian training I could do or other training I could do. I just don't have the time anymore. So my wife and I decided, hey, let's put your, I feel a lot more, it's not like civilian, there's no satisfaction there. Learning is learning. And when you see that light bulb turn on for anyone, it's the most gratifying thing in the world. It's like self-serving, right? But the law enforcement, I feel like they're using this to purpose right away. And whether it could save someone's life or their life, it's being used as a purpose and military and all that stuff. So we're trying to make that as more of a priority this year. And I think years to come. And you know, it just, every time I walk away from some of these week-long law enforcement training, it's exhausting, absolutely exhausting. 'Cause everything that you teach them is, you know, you're thinking about the liabilities and the lawyers and all that stuff. And lucky for me, I've had that exposure when I was working for Department of Homeland Security. But at the end of the day, when I leave that, I will always, the conversation between my wife and I is always like, man, that was exhausting. And I'm exhausted. I'm tired. I don't want to do anything for a couple of days, but I know they did good. Like, I know I did well. And I gave my best in that training. And, you know, it feels so rewarding to know that maybe that particular group will be able to pass on the knowledge or help someone else out that will help him or her or someone else out.
Yeah, especially when you think about the environment that those guys are working in, that just being able to manipulate their firearm, you know, as compared to what we do, is in, if they're pulling a gun out, there's a reason for it. It has nothing to do with a timer. It has nothing to do with, you know, a stage breakdown or anything. It's because there's the opportunity to use it is pretty good. And it's going to be, you know, broken down and studied, like you said, by lawyers and judges and the media and all kinds of stuff now, especially with body cameras and cell phone cameras, the scrutiny that those guys are under to make sure that if they are in a life and death situation, that they're able to succeed for themselves, for their families, for the department that they're in, and that there's nobody else getting harmed and, you know, the person that was the aggressor against them. So, it's cool that you're able to bring the competition world, because I think even those guys start to recognize who you are, who Bob Vogel is, who Max is, just because, this isn't as hidden as it used to be.
Right.
Right. I mean, while it's not mainstream, these guys do see your guys' video and your Instagram pages and, you know, the big companies that, you know, maybe having, you know, Berettas that they're using and you're coming and working with them, and, you know, hey, this is my competition gun compared to the gun that you have in your holster. So I can imagine that's pretty cool to see.
The evolution?
Yeah.
Or dancer,
just the, right? Yeah. The change from standing on a static firing line and shooting at the paper, you know, that old kind of target that we used to look at that had that kind of ogre looking guy that was on there you're shooting that at 3 yards. And at the beginning of the class, their groups were barely on there. Yeah. And you spent 4 hours with them and you taught them how to grip a gun and line sights up, and they went home and they felt great. Now you guys are incorporating all kinds of different stuff, and a lot of it has transitioned over to what we do in competition.
And that's the coolest thing about it, is to be a part of it in the beginning. Right. I look back, I always consider myself still pretty young, but at the same time, I've been around a long time. So I'm pretty old in that sense. So when I started teaching in the law enforcement, the first time I jumped in, I got so much slack for being a competition shooter. Like, hey, all that stuff that you do doesn't apply here, man. So just teach what we teach. All that stuff that you do when we go to the force and force, stick to the gun, stick to the principles, the technique, you know, check your boundaries and sectors of fire, whatever it may be. And then don't do what you do in competition. And I remember I was like, I don't do what I do in competition unless it's time to pull the trigger, when I've decided, right? The biggest, early on, I started recognizing that there's dynamics, unknowns and knowns versus our world in competition. Everything should be a known. Like, there should be no surprises for us, right?
There are sometimes.
Right. If there's a surprise, it's usually never good.
Yeah.
So I started dissecting that, and I'm like, man, but when I don't really have to think about my movement so much, my tactics, where my partners are, who's around me, the civilians versus the role players and the real threats out there. Because I didn't worry about my shooting. I just reacted. Like, if I had to pull a trigger, I presented the gun. If I didn't have cover, I knew to move because there was some fear of getting shot back. Right?
Right.
So I started getting that. And I'm like, man, in my head, I'm like, I don't think competition is a bad thing, because I'm able to process things fast. But at the same time, these guys that I've experienced, real world experience, the guys that just came back from Mogadishu, whatever other war they were in at that time, Afghanistan or Iraq, they were telling me like, hey, we don't do a lot of the stuff that you do. So I just kept my mouth shut and just put my head down and just did the work. It was good work. And then eventually now, the evolution now, it's like they want performance shooting. They need to see where the efficiency happens, where we can teach safely, being able to increase speed without teaching them rapid fire per se. Rapid fire does not look good when you're training that in chief of counsel or lawyers or anyone out there. But if you teach them efficiency and all this stuff and life-saving techniques, goodness gracious, that's what they're all about right now.
Yeah, no attorney wants to hear about your bill drill.
No, 100% not.
Right.
Sub-second draws, no.
Yeah. But behind the scenes, there have been some guys doing this for a while. Jerry Barnhart is one. And I think there are other guys that have traveled to some of the military places. I mean, I know that I know that you have, Bob Vogel has, on an annual kind of basis. And that, as those guys, you know, cycle out of their military career, a lot of them go into law enforcement. I think that's where you're starting to see those guys are wanting to bring that same training into the law enforcement side that they went through on the military side.
Yes, And that's the thing where you said, like a bunch of the D-boys that I worked with in contract a long time ago, teaching and stuff like that, they were the guys that were exposed to the Jerry Barnhart's, the Mike Boyd, and the Rob Latham. And they're like, they were always the guys who were like, hey, dude, he goes, do what you do. Because the guys that you compete with right now, I remember getting the questions like, hey, how do you fare out against Jerry Barnhart? And that was 2003. And I said, man, I almost beat that sucker 2001 in open. And they're like, what do you mean you almost beat him? I'm like, no, like I almost beat him. He goes, you're that good? Why are you working here? You're not, why aren't you doing what he's doing? I'm like, I don't know what he's doing. Right. And then, yeah. And then they're like, so you're good enough to beat Jerry. And I'm like, I don't know. But there was one match at Nationals that I did lose to him by like 1 point something points. And I was supposed to be, it was supposed to be mine. But anyway, the D-boys, the CAG Delta guys, they were always like, hey, just do your thing. You're doing good. Because that's what the guys that we bring in into our unit and stuff like that, or the other guys, like some other groups are like, that doesn't apply to us and stuff like that, which is really weird and very torn. But then, you know, you only come across so many Delta guys because there's so very few of them. And those guys right. were the ones that just kept saying, hey, and then now, you know, in these days, they're, you know, Special Forces and all these guys are bringing you in all types of ways now, from PJs to SWATs to specialized units in the military, force performance efficiency shooting.
Right. Well, and I think some of that also is you know, the world that we live in has also yeah. changed quite a bit. So it does transfer over. So when you decide to make the jump, I mean, obviously you're going from a paycheck to all of a sudden you're going to be kind of self-sponsoring yourself. You did for a while there. You had the store in Vegas that you were running that. And then you got, you know, stood up and said, all right, I'm going to go full time and I'm going to go in, which was really, the store. When did you pull out of the store? 2018,
2019, October 2019. Yeah.
Okay. Which if nobody ever got a chance to go and see, the Magna Sports store that was there, right. I got to go in the one time, and just to see those high-end custom guns in one spot it's not a gun store that you would normally see. So no. it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But what made that decision? Cause I know in 2018, you were all in on Nationals. That's when we had the 9 days of Nationals with the back to back to back, which you almost pulled off, you know, the hat trick. It was close. It was very close, but you almost pulled it off, which was pretty impressive. Was coming out of that year kind of one of those deciding factors of just like, man, if I just had put a little bit more time and effort into my training, I could be, you know, going around winning these area matches, winning all these Nationals, preparing for World Shoot. Was that kind of part of your thinking?
You know, it's funny that question literally comes back like 10 years, 2008, 2017, there was something that happened at work that almost got me severely hurt or probably not non-existent. Right. And so I remember thinking, man, I got to focus more on my job. I got to start working on these tactics and learning all these things, understanding everything that we did. So whatever school they sent me, I went as much as I could. Right. And then 2008, I tried to quit shooting, like stop out of competition shooting. And I said, I'm only going to shoot one match. I'm going to focus on my job and be really good with what I currently do. And at the time I was trying to try out for a group called GRT. That was going to be a very hard elite group that I needed to try out. So I focused on all that stuff. And then 2008, I shot the Nationals. And I remember it was like Bozeman, Montana or something like that. And I came in second out of nowhere. Like I wasn't even anywhere near competitive, but I came in second. I think I came in second by like 20 or 30 points. And Chris Tilley looks at me and he goes, gosh, dang, dude. He goes, we didn't see you all year and you got second. And I said, I remember thinking, man, maybe I need to stick to around. If I just put a little bit more time in this, I may have done a little better, right? I may have gotten my Nationals. Fast forward 10 years later, 2017, I didn't shoot very many Magna matches from 2015 to 2017. I was trying to start the store. I was the co-owner of it. However, I was, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. It was all about grabbing licenses and all this stuff, right? And then my wife was at the time was actually assigned to the Hillary Clinton campaign, and she was Secret Service. So she was traveling around more. I saw her more on TV than actually in person. And so I had the kids, the 1-year-old and the 3-year-old at the time. So it was very rough on me in regards to my schedule because I was trying to start a business. I had no family in Vegas. It was just me and my kids. And we had an au pair that came in that was able to help out, but she was only like 9-to-5 type, right? And so the rest of the time was me. So I couldn't, once I got home from work, I had to go stay home from work. I couldn't go to the range and train because I had my kids. And then once my kids went to sleep, right, I had to take care of the business stuff. And then it was like a very bad cycle for a while. So 2016 to 2017, I didn't really shoot. 15, 16, and 17, didn't really shoot much. I think 3 or 4 matches or so, maybe try to hit nationals here and there. And just always ask my wife to come, my dad to come help me out with the kids. And that year, 2017, the world championship happened. And for some reason, I come in again second overall in the world, right? Losing by like 20 points. And I remember thinking, man, I had a good chance at this if only I had a full year of training.
Right.
And then 2018 SHOT Show, I remember sitting down with Tanfoglio and a couple other sponsors, and they're like, hey, we're going to re-sign you again. We didn't think you were going to shoot anymore. We thought you were going to go in the business aspect of it. We didn't think you were going to compete. So we're just going to re-sign you the same contract. And I said, well, I can't accept that same contract because I no longer have a salary. So that contract was good because I was only shooting like 3 or 4 matches a year, but I had a salary back me up. And I said, so what do you want? I said, a living wage. I don't know what I'm asking for, but I need something a lot more than this, like more like 5 times more than this. And yeah, sure enough, they were like, well, we didn't see any of that, right? We only got the world shoot. And we can kind of say that's luck. And a lot of them literally was like, hey, this is all we're going to offer. And I'm like, take it or leave it. And I'm like, well, shoot, I'll leave it. I was like, I'm going to take a chance. If I do well in 2018, that should show them I'm in it for the long haul. I can focus on this and put everything that I can. 2018, I had a great year, luckily. In 2019, opportunities opened up, right? CZ wanted it. And then Beretta came. And there were so many other doors that I can open. And then it just started to happen. It started to click. And then I started to click as well. Started believing in myself like, hey, there we go. Now you got time. The range was 7 minutes away. I can drive, train. I can juggle all this. My wife was now there and can help me out with the kids. And it was just amazing. Like once my wife got back into life, it was just truly amazing. I started turning the leaf and page and just started really cranking it off. And then it was just another one of those things, another decent year. Not as good as 2018, but it was a decent year. I think I won limited nationals that year. It was like the first time I did back-to-back both in limited. And then 2020 was one of those years that was like, all right, I can, 2019, at the end of it, I was like, I can leave. I don't need this because this is just eating up more of my time. I wasn't getting paid salary. I was just part owner, basically costing money, right?
Right.
As an owner, you cost yourself money. Whatever money I made through gunsmithing, I put it right back in the shop. And so I was like, hey, this is going to hurt the shop, but I'm going to need to do what's best for me because I can't, now that I'm training a lot, I'm shooting a lot, I have to have time for my family. And it was one of those things that the relationship needed to be developed again, because I think that's being gone that much is not healthy, right? When I'm home, I'm not really home because I'm working about the shop. I'm constantly concerned about money and all this stuff. And then when I'm gone at competition, I'm not home neither, right? So now when I'm home, right? Which is really cool. So I had to leave and let go of the shop. That was a conversation between Edwin and I. I said, hey, and then he was like, hey, I respect your decision. He goes, it's not good. It's not what I want. And so we parted ways 2019. And yeah, since then, full-time Beretta, Seymour, sponsored pro shooter, USPSA, IDPA once in a while, but USPSA mainly, right? And then now I train in the morning. I get home. I prepare myself more physical development or cleaning, tweaking guns. And then really when I'm home, I'm with my wife, especially with COVID, how she's able to work more from home. We spend as much time as we can. And then my kids, when they're home, I'm home with them.
Right.
Pretty awesome.
Well, and you brought up your wife, Mrs. Fracasa, and I don't think a lot of people know what her career was, and that, I mean, for a very long time, you guys were living in different parts of the country.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, some of us know, some of us don't, that she was within the Secret Service and actually an assigned agent on details. But now you guys are all stationed in Florida.
Yeah.
More or less. Well, you're there. She's stationed.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
But a little bit more of what would be considered more of a normal life than what you've had for probably, you know, what, 10 years,
gosh,
15 years?
15 years, yeah.
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 Yeah. So, yeah. So if you see JJ's wife at a match, don't, you know, don't assume that she's just standing over there and just, you know, his pretty something. Wife on the side. Right. Yeah. Yeah. She sees, you know, 360 degrees around her and can tell you everything that's going on because she has a very, yeah, she has a very impressive background in law enforcement as well.
She was a certified badass. Like, I was 18. Yeah. I mean, most people don't know the difference between 1801 and 1811. She was an 1811 special agent, like legit girl that did it. She's no slouch. She's like 6'1". I tell her she's always claiming to be like 5'11". BS. Her driver's license says 6'1". She's like top mega fighter. She rolls. She can shoot. She's a B1 athlete. Like she's no slouch.
Right, right. She actually, I think she probably is the one that kind of holds you to your fitness regimen that you've kind of, you know, have taken on. You know, she'll be the one that gives you shit if you're not out there doing stuff, right?
She does. She knows that I don't really enjoy the training part of it, like the working out. I don't really like that, but it's something that I have to do. So she'll give me, and she knows I'm very competitive. She'll help me up with like, oh, looking a little loose today or this week, huh? Like, say what?
Right. Well, I think a lot of people follow your guys's life, you know, vicariously through your Instagram and stuff. Cause I mean, you don't hide anything on there. And you guys are constantly, giving each other grief and having fun. Right. But I think if people understand the lifestyle that you guys had before where you couldn't do any of that stuff. I mean, she did not have a public life as JJ Rikaza's wife because of her career. And now that that's kind of changed, you guys obviously are having a lot of fun with it. And I think people watch it and stuff. I mean, and I'll scroll through your stories and like, God, good Lord, you know, how much time does this guy have to do all this stuff?
Yeah. It's really crazy. It's like,
because you tag me and everything though, too. So
it's like, the thing is like, I look back and my wife and I always have this conversation. It's like, we didn't really have a childhood. I didn't have a childhood, much of a childhood. Like I was training, like shooting. I had a 6-week layoff, right? And that was my time to be a kid. But like when I was 18, 19, I started training again for shooting. And it was always serious training. Couldn't go to spring break, couldn't do any of that. So my maturity level never really left 18. that's my thing. So now that we have some time together, oh man, I'm a pain in the ass in her butt. Like I bust her chops and she is just as good at giving it back. So I started capturing it on video, like the stuff that I do just to see. And that's gotten me more responses than anything I do in regards to shooting. Even the sexiest thing I'll do in shooting, the espresso is one of the hits, the dumb things that I do, the funny things that I do with her and how she's about to kill me is what's more of interaction on Instagram than anything else.
And what's funny about that? And I get a lot of grief as being the media director of USPSA, where people go to our Instagram page and they see where I reshare, you know, match videos.
Why not my videos? Yeah, I bet you get that a lot.
Well, I get tagged in all kinds of stuff. And then, you know, some of them I can't reshare just because they're playing crappy music in the background, or you hear somebody cussing, or they have a wall of words with hashtags in there that I'm not going to spend all this time deleting. But just to give you an idea, right? So I can share a video of yours that if it picks up and is kind of viral, maybe 8, 9, 10,000 reach. I shared a video of a 9-year-old kid from the Florida State match last month.
I saw that.
1.7 million views of this kid. I ended up banning or deleting over 700 comments of watching a kid shoot a gun. So I'm somewhat selective on what we post and what we share, but it's promoting, and I'll share videos from you guys sometimes. Sure. But the funny thing is that, you know, an average guy kind of like me, you know, late 40s out there shooting, I sometimes will get more views out of that than I will, you know, your run.
Correct.
And sometimes it has the opposite effect when I sit there and I follow the comments. It was, oh, that's awesome. I could never do that. That's really cool. He's really super fast. I could never do that. And then I put a video of, a 250-pound guy out there, B-class shooter. And you see more comments where they tag people are like, hey, we should try this. Right. This would be great.
It normalizes it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, we know that there's different – anybody who's involved in the sport of shooting knows that there's always different levels of shooters. There's like your guys' level, guys that have been doing it for a while. So you still see Todd. You still see Rob. You still see these guys coming out that have been doing this for 40 years. Yes. I think Rob's coming up on 40 years, right? Or yes. 41 years?
Over 40, yes. Todd is coming up with 40 and Rob's over 40.
Yeah. Because Rob, with his back-to-back single-stack nationals, I believe it was the first one was his 40th anniversary of shooting.
Yeah.
Was that. Still out there doing it. And then you guys are kind of you, Max, Travis,
Blake, Casey.
Yeah. Kind of like generation two.
Yes.
Right. Kind of mid 90s, 15, 20 years. And now you've got the Christian Seilers and, like Trace Decker,
Decker. Right? So, yes.
Yeah. Aaron. Out of nowhere.
Aaron. Yeah. Right. Like,
guys that have been doing it for two or three years. I mean, Christian's been doing it a little bit longer than that are now that kind of third level of shooter. And then on the Steel Challenge side of it.
Oh my gosh. Unreal. The 22s, the rim fires, those guys.
Well, that was funny. So Kobe Pavlock and Casey were standing there at the last World Speed Shooting Championship. And Casey's like, I'm kind of like the old guy here now. And Colby, who's 22, 23, and he was like, I kind of feel like the old guy over here. And I'm like, I'm not going to say anything because I'm 10 years older than you and 20 years older than you. So
that's crazy
how you see it, right?
The evolution, right? The constant change of like the guard, essentially. I remember when we were young and we would run around, Casey, Max, and I, and Bobby and Todd and Jerry would just look at us and murmur, or Mike Boyd would just murmur behind the side, like, look at these kids, right?
Right. Especially when Jerry used to put those camps on, right? When you guys would go to Jerry's camps.
Goodness gracious. I never got to go to Jerry's camp. I missed it because either time or whatever it was, I could never do it. But I've heard so much about it. And that was... I've always wanted to go because Jerry was my hero. But anyway, I felt like that at Open Nationals, I think it was this year. And then it was even worse. It was Production Nationals. I think it was last year. Phil and I were talking, Phil Strader. And like, dude, what are the oldest freaking dudes here?
Right.
And the only thing keeping me together is because I'm Asian. So I'm like, I'm stuck to kind of blend in, Phil. Let me put some business to you. It was like, what's wrong with me? I said, well, you're looking old, bud.
Yeah, Phil. You look 10 years older than you actually are.
Yes.
And you're old.
He's my age. Right?
No. So you come out of that, and Beretta picks you up officially at the end of 2020, right?
It was 2019, I think they picked me up.
2019?
Hold on a second. Let me think. 2020. 2019. Yes, I was already because I went to Italy. I went to Italy just before COVID happened, right where the heart of Brescia.
Okay. So coming out of 2019 into 2020 before the world kind of shut down.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. That's right, because they were introducing the 92X Performance.
Yes. At the SHOT Show 2019.
Yeah. And then production wise, it kind of picked up and started taking off for them. So how do you switch platforms like that? Now on the production side of it, you were already double action, single action. So that wasn't a huge transition because you were shooting, the Tanfoglio stock twos for a while.
So it wasn't,
but how do you do that in open?
It's a huge, that one. So production, carry optics, they're very similar to me. They're a production gun. They're double action, single action gun. It's a competitive gun in that division. Going from a 2011 $8,500 gun to a stock factory open gun, that's a big change. And I didn't expect the challenge to be that much, right? Because I shot Tanfoglios before, and I shot some checkmates before, but I never really spent time behind it the way I am spending time with the Beretta now. So when I shoot the Beretta, I just I remember shooting it 1 year when I started when I was about to shoot it for Nationals for the first time, and there were things that I kept changing, the springs, firing pin spring, working on a trigger because my trigger was like 2.5 pounds. I kept wanting to get it down to like the 1.5 that my former open gun was, and I kept trying to make these changes, and I finally just accepted. I was like, that's going to be my trigger, because if not, it'll go full auto. I don't want that risk. So I'm going to do that. And then next thing I know is like, I never took advantage of my magazine. I never even looked at him. My magazine only carries 26. So I'm like, goodness, this is a week before Nationals. I got to run my big stick as 26 and my small stick is at 21. Like, this is going to be a problem. I hope not. So, right. And you got all these random issues that you come up with and then you encounter. And then through the years, we're starting to develop. Like, now I have a 28, 29 round magazine. I have a better trigger on my gun. It's a much shorter trigger. The timing of the gun's a little better. I still have certain issues learning it. The gun recoils so much more than the 2011 would. Just to give you a perspective, and this is what my Beretta would probably recoil. This is what my open gun 2011 would recoil. So, however, it's still competitive. I knew that if I can pull the trigger correctly, if I just learn the basics of it, I can apply it to open. And then I just, you know, hopefully I'll train hard enough in the gym where my footwork, my movement is going to be better than most. And I will be able to stabilize my sights sooner than most. I can shoot just as good as I can with any other platform. And so that's the struggle right now, is that trying to compete with a $3,000 gun amongst the guys that are shooting $88,000 to $9,000 guns, custom guns out there. So that's the big challenge. And that's all in all, in regards to shooting, it's still shooting, right? It's still me behind the gun, but I am not where I was. Like, I think every time I compared last year, I don't know this year, I haven't done it. Last year when I took my Razor Cat and served some of the standard drills, and then I would compare it back to back with my Beretta, I was about averaging of 3 to 5% off of the pace or the hits with a 2011 than I am with the Beretta. Overall, like, I would run it 500 rounds and it would be 3 to 5% off.
Right. And I've witnessed how you get so prepared before a match, as you were scraping base pads on the concrete that 1 year to make sure they fit the gauge. Right. Little things like that. I mean, things like a B-class guy going to Nationals. I mean, his stuff is right on. Here's JJ Ricazza, a couple world titles and national titles. He's over there on a parking block, you know,
grinding
it down. So I'm glad that you're spending some time working on your mags and,
you know, that's funny. Stuff. I forget. Like, people don't know the stuff that you have.
I went walking by. I saw you over there doing it and I was like, what? I have a picture of it someplace, right? Snapped a picture
you just
of it.
And
it
was to be like at the right place at the right time, every single time. So what people don't understand is that having shooting a prototype gun, although I'm like shooting for one of the most prestigious companies there is, right? It's been around a long time, the gun company,
right?
Beretta, like, it's a household name. It's the most humbling honor experience that I can possibly have as a shooter to represent them and for them to consider me as an asset. To shoot a prototype gun, like, that has no other gun out there. I have the first two, three, four open guns from them. There's stuff that happens, right? Because right. There's not like 1,000 of them that they figured it out. This is it. Like, so 3 days before 2020 Nationals, this is, I'm just going to give you guys what happened, the gist of it, because I was a headache of with Master Giovanni in Italy. He, my comp blows out on my main gun 3 days before. Like, I'm shooting, boom, and I get hit in the face. I'm like, what was that? And I kept shooting. I'm like, man, my gun's acting really weird. And I unload, and I'm like, oh, there's no more freaking comp. Where did it go? I shot it off. No wonder my bullets are a little off. I guess it was hitting the comp. So I clear it up. I'm like, don't worry, Dad, I got a backup. Picked up the backup, right? Shot four rounds into it, and it goes full auto. Brrrada! And like, full auto didn't stop shooting until all the rounds were out of my magazine. And I looked at my dad. He goes, I think we're done practice. I'm like, I don't think I can fix this. So we go home, and I literally had no gun for Nationals. So I would switch, swap, twist off, put this on, and now I have different slide on a different frame. Try to match that together. It works. Let's go to the match and zero it on the match. Like,
right.
And I'll never forget, like, to Frostproof Florida, I was zeroing next to Marco and Dave Murphy. I'm zeroing my open gun, and then my base pad shoots off after the first two rounds, and it shoots off and dumps all my mags and rounds. And Marco goes, hey, that's not good. And my dad immediately noticed it. And he goes, what's that? I'm like, it's just my practice mag. Don't worry about it. That was one of my match mags. I had to make sure he's calm. And I'm just trying to pretend like nothing's wrong. And I pick it up and I go, oh, this Tanfoglio base pad doesn't work on a Beretta magazine. Nope. So I'm like trying to squeeze it. And then I go over to the Chrono. And then they were like, well, your gun's a little, mags are a little too long. And I'm like, gosh dang, I gotta go and shave this off. So I'm grinding it, and that was the night you saw me. And I'm like, yeah. Lesgar was there. I'm just sitting there rubbing it on concrete.
I've had the opportunity to speak to the guys at Beretta, and I went and I visited the plant and the support that they give you, but I don't think people actually realize that those are prototype guns. They're actually, I mean, and you're dealing with one master gunsmith that's in Italy, not here in Maryland or down in Tennessee, that they are, you know, trying things out based on your feedback, you know, and it's, you're overseas trying to get back and forth with them. And plus they had, I mean, they shut down for a while in 2020, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's, I always kind of make the joke about when I do the gun reviews and stuff that I could lay 10 guns out in front of me and I could shoot a drill and my times are always going to be pretty close. Sure. You know, I can shoot pretty much any gun about the same. My hits, not so much.
Yeah.
So you go into 2021 with the 92X Performance. Which we did the review on that gun, myself and Aaron Bright, before in 2020, right before, we went into that season. One of the first guns I ever bought was a 92, the old Inox, right? But it was because of, you know, Die Hard and Lethal Weapon and all that stuff. So I was very excited. That's a gun that I bought after we did the review, and still have it, and just did the review on the 92X Performance Defensive. And I think it's a little funny that people don't realize that you were handed that gun less than a week before IDPA Nationals.
Yeah, give or take. I think it was something like that. And I think I got my gear at Nationals, at IDPA Nationals. Like, they gave me the holster that I needed and the mag pouch that I needed.
I actually saw your stuff because I shot that match the 2 days before. So I came out and talked to Nicola and all that stuff. And there was like, yeah, JJ's coming to shoot this match. And I was like, with what gun? So because they had just introduced the defensive that they made to make weight. Yes. So, yeah.
Yes.
And was this not one of the first IDPA Nationals that you'd shot?
It is the first IDPA match I've ever shot.
Not only was it the first Nationals, but it was the first IDPA match you've ever shot.
Yes. And that's what made it really interesting. And I think why I enjoyed it so much was because of how nervous I was because of all the rules that I didn't know.
Right. And it's completely different. Yes. Right. And you learned that on the one stage. There's controversy around behind all that. Yes. You've explained that. IDPA's explained it. I wasn't there. I do know that when I shot that stage, I was cautioned on my draw, doing essentially the same thing that you did. The thing that was different is how I actually sat with my legs underneath the table instead of kind of crooked back to the side.
Yeah.
But I started in IDPA. So from 2000 to 2004, all I shot was IDPA. Wow. Then I shot my first USPSA match and that was pretty much it. Right. And I've shot a few of them, but, I was out there looking at the range, to see what a big match was like out there before we signed the contracts and had a chance to shoot it. But I was cautioned on that by the same RO.
Yeah. I remember Nils, as soon as I walked away from that stage, Nils goes, I guess there should have been one more rule that we should have covered with you. And I'm like, and at that point, I didn't even know. I was like, whatever. Right. I was DQ'd or whatever. I was like, what did I do?
Yeah. How's this different?
They were like, you sweep your foot. I'm like, I sweep my foot every time I draw my gun. I was like, that just happens. And they're like, but you're seated. I'm like, but what's the difference? I'm standing or seated. And so, yeah, that was, I was like, wait, what's going on here? I'm like, wait, am I getting thrown off? I'm like, I can't get thrown off. I'm winning the match. I was like, how does this, hold up a second. This doesn't compute. And not an idea. I was like, let me ask and talk. What are the routes? And sure enough, I was lucky enough that the speed, I don't know if we should go into this, but the speed apparently, what happened was that I drew it so fast that it created doubt on the RO that called it.
Right. The there wasn't.
Yeah. The RO was it was pretty quick on the gun and out. And he said that doubt alone created the vote. Was they were like, yep, I don't think we can vote it out.
Yeah. And this is the same thing on, I mean, we talk about it on the USPSA side of it. You can, you know, if you're going to make a call on somebody on the 180 or, you know, finger on the trigger or something like that, you can't say, I think. You got to be 100% sure on that. And I believe that's what they fell back to, is that, you know, you were quick on the draw coming out of there, and that's where it was. And then you ended up going and winning that match.
Yes. Yes.
Which, you know, your first IDPA match is also your first IDPA national championship.
So, yes. Only
you could do that, right?
No, I want to take a step back. That RO didn't actually know who I was. I thought he'd heard of me. I thought like, you know, like everyone, when I walked in there, I thought everyone was like, hey, be easy, be careful. You're USPSA Grandmaster. You're known in the USPSA. IDPA is going to want to have a bullseye on your back. So when he DQ'd me, I immediately thought, my gosh, someone finally got me. I did something stupid enough where they got me. When I spoke to him, I got reinstated. And I spoke to him, I said, hey, after I shot the stage, I was super nervous, whatever. After reinstated, I said, hey, I apologize for what happened. I nothing personal. I just want to shake your hand. You know, thanks for saying whatever you said, because it allowed me to reinstate. And he was like, oh yeah, no, I appreciate it. Someone finally walked up to him in front of me, and he was like, hey, do you know who this guy is? He's like, no, I don't know. Who's he? And he goes, hey, that's JJ Ricaza. And he goes, that's the guy right there. He goes, that's JJ. I'm like, yeah, pleasure meeting you. And he's like, oh my God. He goes, I didn't know I DQ'd you. I'm like, well, you didn't, but you did at the same time. And he goes, yeah. I goes, I'm sorry. He was like, no, it's all good. It all worked out. And he's like, man, you're a cool guy. I'm like, I appreciate that.
Hey, and can you sign this scorecard?
Yes. I was like, let me sign that real quick, move on. But yes, I did. Yeah. I did win that.
Let me get your autograph right here for two reasons.
I did win that. And that was a very satisfying feeling to bring a title for Beretta, right? I came close early in the year. I fell a little short, but to bring in a title, that's my job right now, is to bring awareness to the gun that it can perform. And not only that, but to bring titles to them. They want, they're winners. They've been winning all over the world with a shotgun. I wanted to do the same thing. Even though they didn't say that to me, I knew that was my job, is to freaking win.
And all right, so let's talk a little bit about low cap, and we'll talk about the popper. You and I've talked about it. So the first thing, and we talked a little bit about this before we got on here, about your power factor. So I have the 92X Performance and the 92X Performance Defense, two of the Beretta guns, same two guns that you've been shooting, and ammo that runs 133, 134 out of a Walther Q5 steel frame, out of a 1911 with an Allen barrel, out of the 320s. With KKM barrels and standard barrels, runs about 126, 125, 124, same ammo. And it's not that they're not accurate barrels. They're extremely accurate barrels. I just did the review that's in the magazine, shows the inch and a half group I shot with the Ely 124 grain stuff. It's just they're a little bit slower. The twist rate in those barrels are a little bit slower. So I think people thought that you were, you know, the popper issue that you had was because you had, you know, sub-minor ammo. And I personally, having shoot those, I don't believe that was the case. Just knowing that the barrels run a little bit slower. But I think the whole story is, and like I said, you and I have discussed it, is that we had wind that day that was blowing poppers over.
Yeah. The squad before us was all limited 40s.
Right. Yeah. So the squad before them was the ladies super squad that were mostly shooting production. And the it kept blowing over.
Yep.
So they set it, yep. And they set it heavy. They admittedly set it heavy. The next group that came through was single stack and limited 10.
Yeah.
And everybody was shooting major power factor. No issue. It goes down. And then you guys come up and
there were a few of us had issues.
Right.
Yeah.
That it went down on a reshoot for somebody else on your squad. I can't remember who.
There was somebody else on me before, and then they I think it went down, and before me there was somebody else, and then me, and then right after me it was Jared Fox. Jared shot it. Yeah. And Jared I think had a 130 something hit power factor, and did smack center also and didn't fall. And his, however, didn't fall at all when they chrono and got a reshoot.
When they chrono, yeah. So and then you didn't see that it didn't fall, because the way you shot that stage, you fell out to the right.
Yes.
And you were kind of like, unload, show clear.
I'm having fun.
And you hear people in the background all like, he didn't see it. He doesn't see it.
Yeah.
Because you can hear it on Brian Connolly was live.
Yeah.
And you hear people going, he doesn't know. No. He doesn't know.
Yeah. It was Jake Hetherington actually was the one that told me. He's like, hey dude, he goes, that was a great run.
Yeah.
He goes, very efficient. No wasted movement. I said, yeah. He goes, I think I got all off, but that's all I want to do in this. I gave up some points early on, but I feel good now. And he's like, except for that. And I turn around, I said, what? And I still didn't see it until I was like,
right.
I walked up to the RO and the RO was like, wait, we need to chrono that. What do you want to do with that? And I said, do what? And I said, oh my gosh, the popper with the dead center hit. I'm like, what is that? Right. Did someone put it up?
Yeah. Yeah. So, the next day when they tear the match down, the calibration bolt was stripped out because they had been calibrating it, moving it around.
Over, yeah.
Yeah. And I'd shared that information with you about it. And then as you guys, I mean, after that happened, you went basically balls out.
Yes.
On the next five stages, because you knew going into that stage, while you guys were kind of neck and neck.
Yeah.
One of the things, I don't know if you ever went back and read the article that I wrote, but one of the things that I do when I do the Nationals article is I actually take your guys' score, put it in an Excel spreadsheet, and it tallies the scores as you shoot it. And Nils was like 2 points ahead of you going into that. But you guys, I mean, that's how close you guys were.
No, so we were 2 points going into the first stage. But after the first and second stage, remember I screwed it up? Mason and I screwed it up.
You and Mason screwed that up.
I gave a Mike no shoot on the second stage and I got a no shoot on the first stage. So Nils was immediately like 30 points up. So I was like, I'm going to make it up on the big stage. I have a good feeling about that stage and the final two stages. And then I just got to hold it together on this swinger stage. And I was like, if I can sustain this, I can reverse the momentum and I know I can make up 35 points. Well, plus 18 points later, I'm down 48, 43, 50 something points. And I'm like, I got five more stages to go. This is not the way my math was working in my head.
Yeah. I don't know that people remember also that stage right before the popper was, like you said, it was one that you had both you and Mason. Yeah. Kind of messed up. So it was a kind of an accumulation of things.
Yes.
Right. And the funny thing about it is that when I did all those scores at the very last stage, at the speed that Mason shot that in, if he didn't have the delta, I'd have to go back and look, if he didn't have the deltas and he had a miss, if he would have had not the miss and like two less deltas, he would have won the match.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like how close it was that was in there. So, and it's been like that for the last couple of years. No one is just
dominating,
running away.
No,
it's been very interesting to watch the races that you guys have had. So you come out of kind of a heartbreak, right? Because you went into that ready to really pull it off. And Bretta made a big splash. Set up. I mean, they brought in the big trailer. You guys had a video crew that was following you around, shooting shotguns, doing all kinds of stuff. Yeah. And, you know, that's kind of a swift kick in the gut right there. It's like,
was.
I mean, 0.5% of a point, something like that. Then you go to IDPA Nationals and you've got a half a day of uncertainty of what you're going to do.
Yeah. Like,
did I DQ? Did I not DQ? Yeah. Did I win? And you're just sitting over there going, no, I won. I don't care what you guys say. And then you got to change guns again. I mean, you came out of September
IDPA.
Going into October for carry optics first and then open. And I think you were more focused on open because tell me if I'm wrong, but you didn't think you were shooting carry optics to prepare for open.
No. So
it wasn't, you weren't going in there thinking you were probably thinking you're going to be in the top five, but you weren't thinking you were going to walk away with the win. Were you?
So I'm going to share some tidbit of information a little bit. So the problem the entire year last year was I only had certain amount of minor load, right? For production, carry optics and IDPA. So I had 1,500 rounds left for carry optics. So I was like, I can't shoot any matches, but carry optics is there. And then so when I practice, I would practice maybe 100 or 200 with carry optics, but my open is my main gig. I was like, that's going to be the one that I'm going to make a run for. But every time I ran it, both guns, I would always see my times to be very similar to each other. There wasn't much difference, except if I take away the first shot, everything was like the same. Right. And I'll go, all right, there's something to this. So Max and I, 2 weeks prior to carry optics, went to Vegas together to teach the pro shooter experience. While over there, we had an opportunity to practice together like a day before. Like we had 2 hours to each other. It's like, hey, let's just go shoot some of this stuff. We would shoot. And then I would look at my time and I'm like, I'm a half second faster than Max with my open decent hits. And he's, I was like, I know my production, my carry optics is very similar to my open time. So I should be, because I had no idea what the pace is in carry optics, right? Because I'd never shot it before.
Right.
So,
because you can't shoot it like open.
No, you can't, right? So I was like, well, I'm going to see. And the difference where I had with Max versus me there was going to carry optics. I had information on how and the pace he shoots or his shot, at least in training, not in matches. It's totally different match. Max is a freaking absurd shooter in matches. Unreal. So, and I'll tell you a story about the first stage. So, so I kept shooting and I remember thinking, man, if I just continue to do what I do right now with my carry optics and I'll continue to match it up with my open, I think I'll do well in carry optics where I might have, Max has dominated this. So I think if he's the guy to match with and measure, I have a decent chance of winning. So leading up prior to that practice session, I think I may be top three, top two. I was like, I don't think there's any other open shooter but Max. So Max is really my only main concern there. So that was my thought process first. Oh, if I shoot open, I'm going to be faster than most. And then I didn't know how I was going to shoot with the gun. But when I went to train with Max, I saw how he shot and I saw some of his struggles, some of my struggles and strengths and stuff like that. I'm like, well, I think I'll be all right. I'll match up really well with Max. Except the problem that I'm going against is that I'm an unknown. I don't know how I'm going to do in match. Max has done this for 7 years and dominated this game for 7 years. So he's got that momentum and going side. And then maybe I looked at it as convincing as a competitor. There's a lot of pressure on his side too. Now that there's a lot of people showing up to carry optics, there might be more pressure on him to try to perform and this and that. But man, so I was like, all right, I'm going to do whatever I do. So my plan was to shoot the normal pace I would shoot as if I was shooting it in open, but just being a little bit more dialed in with my hits. That was my plan. I was like, if I need to change that, I'll change it. But whether I'm going to look at the time in my hits, I'm going to change it if according to the standings, not according to any kind of other results, individual singular results. So I shot my first stage. I felt pretty decent at it. I was like, all right, not bad. And immediately I was like the winner of the stage or leading the stage right away. I'm like, good. I'm comfortable with that. Max goes out there and shoots. And then remember, Max was like 4 or 5 people behind because I was one of the first up shooters. Max shoots. And no one was close to my time. Maybe a half a second was the closest. Max goes out there and destroys it by a second and a half. It was like 16-0 something and I was like 17. And I remember I go, what the fudge was that? I'm like, that looked like a panic kid shot, but freaking connected. And I looked at Phil and I go, Phil, is this how it is shooting against Max and carry optics? He goes, there you have it, buddy. This is what we've been dealing with for the last 7 years. And I remember looking at my dad. You know, my dad's always there. I looked at my dad. I'm like, Dad. He goes, that was the Max that I haven't seen in a while. And he goes, well, I guess you got your hands full, right? He goes, but it's only one stage. maintain your course. It goes, if you were second, you're going to be second, but it's going to be between you and him. Who knows what happens in the second and third and fourth day? I was like, oh, right. I'm not going to change anything. He's like, don't change anything. Maintain the course. He's like, all right, maintain the course. And that's, sure enough, at the end of the day, like, I think I was 1 point in the lead. And I was like, I want to change to be more accurate, but I'm like, you know what? Screw it. Let's maintain the course. Changing now, we may not, you know, veer differently.
Well, and then, so, and the flow of that match and the stages, each zone was very, very different.
Yes.
In the, how the stages and the technical side of the stages were. And knowing you guys kind of like I do, zone three played a little bit more into your style of shooting than Max's style of shooting, because that's where more distance was. And I know that I've watched you, you know, give Max shit about that, you know, shooting stuff at distance is not his game. So, and how the flavor of the match and kind of how, when I designed it and using, the guys that I did with Walt Pagel design and stages, Mike Howell and then Shannon, I knew how the flow was going to go. As far as, you know, a little bit more technical and stage breakdown in zone one, a little bit more fast shooting in zone two, and in zone three, it was a combination of everything. Yeah. You had to bring it for zone three, and that was your third day, and that was kind of the idea behind the match. When people ask me, did I think it was going to be repeats again, I said, you know, there's a lot of new players that are in Carry Optics that are going to be bringing a lot of pressure. Not that Max didn't have a lot of competition the years before, but the competition level was a little bit different.
Yeah.
With having more people that he was familiar with shooting with.
Yes.
Because you weren't on the Carry Optics Super Squad previously.
I never shot Carry Optics in general.
Right.
Yeah.
So you come out of IDPA, first IDPA match, first IDPA national championship. You actually win Carry Optics as an unclassified shooter, because you've never shot Carry Optics in a USPSA match to get classified.
Yes. But you know, it's funny.
You got a match bump.
I did. I got an email from, I think it was Rick, sent me a busted my chops,
right,
and go, hey man, he goes, you probably got the highest match bump there is, but he goes, you need to learn to shoot some matches in order for you to earn the top part of this, right, of this top 20 GM CO scores. So the IDPA actually gave me that little glimpse of hope of going, man, you can possibly, if you just do you can win nationals even if you didn't train for it. Like, that was the only thing that really, no one should come out never shooting the nationals or a match of that division and just come out right win. Like, I remember saying that, and I truly believe that, like, you have to earn your way through. Like, I've earned my way through open, I've earned my way through limited, right? Like, I was like, you have to earn your way through Carry Optics, and especially the stack that was there, like the heavy hitters that were there, no way. And then, but after the first day, I remember thinking, like, maybe this is kind of like what IDPA kind of showed me, that I can do this. Okay, let's just continue to do it. And then I just repeated that mantra, man. It was just like, you're one of the baddest. It's the dumbest thing in the world, but I just kept saying it at night. Like, oh, you're the baddest shooter, pistol shooter there. One of the baddest pistol shooters. I started with one of the baddest pistol shooters, but no one knows this, right? I won't say this out loud. I just kept saying it over and over. Like, you're one of the baddest shooters, so you should be able to do this. You're one of the, I said, you know what? You're not one of the baddest. Like, you're the freaking baddest shooter, pistol shooter there is. I'm like, and I can't say it. I got amped, and the next day I went to go work out like 4 a.m. and I'm like, I'm ready to freaking go. And I was like, all right, let's do this. My dad was like, hey, listen, he goes, just 2 days before, I thought we were coming in here to shoot open if you ask my dad, he thought, because we were in our last day of training, we shot open for about 300 rounds, shot Carry Optics 200, and then we switched back to open for another 300 rounds to finish the training with the open gun. And then when we show up to the match, my dad was like, oh, Max, you're shooting open? He goes, hey. He goes, Jeff, you're shooting open? Like Jeff Emmerich. And he's like, Mason, you're shooting open? Everyone's like, what open? No, we're shooting Carry Optics. He goes, no, this is open. He's arguing with the guys that are there. And he finally pulls me aside. He goes, you're shooting Carry Optics? I'm like, yeah. He goes, why are we practicing open? I'm like, because we don't have ammo for Carry Optics.
Right. I remember you saying that when he was like, he was got the match schedule backwards.
He was freaking out.
Yeah. Well, you come off of that win, which obviously, you know, like you said, you weren't expecting it. But then as the match progressed, you saw that you had a very, very good opportunity to take that win going into the last day. But then you had 3 days off because the way the schedule worked, it wasn't the traditional back to back where there was a day off or immediately. So you had to go into open. What did you do between the two matches? Did you go and shoot some?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was a hard thing. Like I don't even till this day, I think to this day, I never really, like, I think just up to last week or 2 weeks ago or something like that, I was able to, someone recorded my speech at Nationals and I just sat there and enjoyed my speech. And I go, and I kind of relived the moment of me winning that Nationals. Cause at that time I couldn't relish on the moment. I had to move forward and forget the win and start over again. Like, this is starting from scratch. And I remember flying back home, and as soon as we landed, we left some of our stuff in my car. As soon as we landed, Marco and I went straight to the range and shot open. Like, practiced for about an hour, 2 hours that day. Came home, messed with the kids and all that stuff. The next day, we trained again the next morning. And then we trained all about 4 hours the next day for open. And then I believe it was like Thursday, we had to fly back. But I think I flew back Tuesday afternoon, Wednesday I trained. Tuesday afternoon I trained, Wednesday I trained. And then Thursday I had to go back and get ready for open. And that was my schedule. So it was a very tight turnaround, and it was just literally making sure the gun was zero, making sure I could still execute some of my shots. May not be fast because the timing's slightly different, but I knew that open, like, shooting carry optics gave me a slight advantage of having to feel the course a little bit, getting to run it a little bit more, maybe be a little bit more calmer. But man, once you're up there, when it's your turn, it doesn't matter if you shot the match just the day before or not, you're going to feel that same pressure all over again. At least I do, right? I like being nervous, so I'll feel that pressure all over again. And then you get excited as if it's a whole different match altogether.
And this time, because we had the day off, the stages changed quite a bit.
It did.
So there was, there wasn't that kind of familiarity that you had. Yeah. It changed up enough that, you know, the flow, because zone one became extremely technical.
Yes.
Not only technical, but had a lot more difficult shots than it did. And then zone three actually eased up.
A lot eased up.
Quite a bit.
Yep.
Yeah. So, which was all kind of, you know, behind the scenes, I can tell you that it was a little bit planned. I know people think we kind of wing it, but I spend a little bit of time putting some plans into place. Sometimes they work out, sometimes they don't. This time it worked out pretty well, where it did really change the flavor of the match and kind of threw people off. I think coming in, when you went and walked the stage, like the first stage, you were like, hang on.
I remember.
Where'd those poppers come from?
100%. I remember walking up. The consensus was it was a lot easier than carry optics because they took off the PCC. There's no more 50, 40-yard shots. And I go, okay, it's a lot easier. I'm like, why would they make it easier? It's like, no freaking way they would make it easier. It's like, it's no longer half targets over there. It's full target swingers now. And I'm like, what? I was like, why would they make it easier for open? I'm like, that doesn't make sense. I was like, all right, so let me walk. I still remember walking first stage, and I walked by Jay Hirschberg. And I said, hey, I heard it's a lot easier than carry optics. And Jay Hirschberg goes, I don't know what they're seeing. And I go, okay, all right, I trust you. So let me walk my first stage. And I walked. I'm like, this is not easy. I remember because I started day one.
A lot more change up in speed too.
There was a lot more switch ups, and people don't recognize those. Oh, the targets are close. Yeah. I'm like, no, this to that is a trap. This to that is a trap. And if you don't pay attention to this, you're going to lose a whole lot of points. And I remember thinking bay one was probably one of the harder bays on open as opposed to with the way it was in carry optics. Bay three was the hardest. Like, by far, that was the hardest, right? Bay one was the hardest. Bay two was so-so. And then bay three was way easier, but it wasn't any easier than any other bays in regards to its own style and stuff like that and the challenges that it brought, right? So bay one was more like, hey, we got to be more precise with our shots. There's not really much time for open gears here and fourth and throttle down. It's all about like throttling up only to throttle right back down as quick as possible.
Yeah, and that is having Shannon come in and help with that stuff and then bringing in a couple other stage designers and match directors.
Yes, they did.
Because I just did this on the podcast with Troy and Jody and Kevin. I mean, I have a certain flow about the stages that I do. Like if you've shot any of my matches and you go someplace else, you can go, this is a Jake Martin stage, right? So, and it gets a little stale. Even like for the classic match, I have two guys that are kind of designing stages right now that are completely different than my style of stages. And that's going to be, I think people will be interested to see that that's going to have a very, very Ipsic feel to Oof. It. So it's, when we say classic, it's not going to be 3-2-1. It's probably going to be more like 3-2-2
Oof.
Kind of thing. And we're going to make use of those big, huge bays to put some more medium courses in there, but not necessarily our traditional medium courses with 10 or 11 hit factor. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Well, I mean, you're going to be limited in capacity anyway. So that's going to drive the hit factor down a little bit, but, I'm changing it up a little bit for that one. So 2022, what are your goals? What are you looking at doing? You're kicking off the year. I mean, you've got a couple of matches coming up here in the first part of the year. Area six, I think you're going to.
Yes. Yes. Florida and then you've got, and then Area 6, I believe, is right next. Or Alabama, then Area 6, I believe.
Yeah, so it's Florida Open, Alabama, Area 6. And then Magnus Cup.
Oh, Dragons Cup. Yes, that's right.
Dragons Cup, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Is there in May. And then you'll go into, I'm assuming, to start preparing for Carry Optics Nationals. That's in September?
Yeah, I saw.
Or are you, it's kind of, are you concerned about World Shoot?
So it's... It's a mix right now, right, in my head. I'm shooting really well with the Carry Optics, knock on wood. My open, it's progressing, which is good, but I picked up the Carry Optics this year and just felt home right away. Like, I'm shooting, and sometimes I'm even outrunning some of my open gun times, right? It's more apparent. So my dad and I had a conversation. Nicola is just kind of like my mom. He's like, hey, he goes, I think we need to discuss the direction of our marketing ploy and what gun you'll be using. And so I'm supposed to have a phone call with him here in a little bit. But I believe we're going to end up focusing more on Carry Optics this year. I'm still going to hit, obviously, Carry Optics Nationals by itself, which is good. And then I'm still going to hit Open Nationals this year. Because I think, and that's probably going to, if World Shoot happens, I have to be in the Open Division. I can't switch mid-year now and be like, hey, I'm going to shoot Carry Optics, whatever. So I have to finish that whole bit and gig. But I think the Beretta's direction wants me to go to Carry Optics in that direction more, essentially. So this year, majority of it is going to be mostly Carry Optics. I think that was just a recent decision within the last week, but I'm going to try to, I have more major load than I do minor. So I'm going to try to shoot my major load as my practice for my Carry Optics, if that makes even any sense to anyone.
Well, you'll definitely learn how to track the dot better.
Yes, for sure.
So, and the actual gun that you were shooting is the 92X Performance. But right now it's got the defensive slide that's on there because that's how it's coming with the optics cut.
Yes.
The 92X Performance, I believe, is going to be coming with the new slide mid-year.
I think so. Early this year to mid-year, yes.
Yeah. And with the new safety.
Yeah.
Because that's the other thing. Just in case anybody, if they want a production gun like JJ shoots, the first thing you got to know is that the safeties – are too wide. The right side, or if, depending on which hand you are. Yeah. So you can either trim it off, or I believe that they do have in the Beretta shop online the more, what I refer to as the tactical safety versus the target safety. Yeah. And I did the same setup as you. So I took the 92 defensive slide and put it on the performance frame and weighed it out. And it's with optic, with mag, with base pad, it's a 50 and a half ounce gun.
Are you still at, I was at 44 ounces at Nationals. And I think it's also because I also have the plastic guide rod.
Okay. So, yeah. So with the stainless guide rod, and depending on what your base pad that you're using.
Yeah, I'm using the Tony system, so it's pretty light. That's the lightest one. I think the J-Speed are heavier and all that stuff.
And the grips. So the plastic grips don't weigh as much as if you go with the with the Tony Systems metal grips.
Yes.
So yeah, you can sit right about 50 ounces.
Correct.
Compared to like the SIG 320s that I've been running, the Max 320s with the tungsten guide rod and the tungsten grip plug, they're 48 ounces.
Yeah.
So there's some pretty heavy duty, you know, fat boy guns that are out there.
Yeah.
The optic, you're running the Seymour RTS2, but I believe you have some new ones coming from Seymour that they just introduced at SHOT Show.
They didn't introduce it. They're still behind the scenes, but they do have a smaller version of it.
Right.
The defensive version of it. But that's not going to be the one for competition. The new one, it's very, I can't wait for it to come out. It's exciting. Cause that one, I mean, you know, anything new is exciting. You know, with any version ones, there's always going to be some issues, but I'm excited to test it out. Cause it's a bigger field of view as usual. You want to see
right.
and stuff like that.
I mean, that's what they're known for, right? Yeah, I mean, they pretty much set the standard in the competition world with that Seymour sight.
They did.
Well, that is awesome. So coming out of this, and I know that you probably get people asking about doing training classes and competition classes and stuff. Where can they, and just so you know, it's JJ's wife who handles his schedule for him.
Yes.
So if you get a hold of him and are like, hey, can you do a class 3 Saturdays from now? And JJ says, yes, that's not true.
Yes.
You got to get a hold of Mrs. Ragazza because yes. he has no idea what he's doing or where he's going.
Yeah. So if you want to get a hold of me in class, there's so many people that reach out to me on Instagram. Hey man, I'd love to have a private and I'd love to fly you here, fly you there. I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. That sounds cool. And then
right.
it never happens because my wife was never involved. If my wife gets involved, like it'd be amazing. Like, so I tell people don't hit me up. Don't ask me, ask my wife. So if you ever want, it's jessica.racaza. It's RACAZA @yahoo.com. Jessica, normal jessica.racaza. That's it.
Yeah. And then she can let you know about your schedule, yes. where you're going to be. And if you got anything, do you have any competition classes coming up here that you know that are either full, not full,
yeah,
or that you're getting set up?
Now? Where is for you?
So for me, I'm still in Indianapolis.
Oh, geez.
But yeah. So my schedule, starts getting a little crazy. I'm actually meeting Shannon Friday at Clinton House, South Carolina, to look at the range one more time for Multigun Nationals. Nice. And I drive over to Atlanta and fly out to sit down with Sandy and Brandon Strayer to talk about 2022 in the Infinity Open and some of the stuff that they want to do. And then as soon as I get back, I go back up to Vortex.
Oof.
So I'm all over the place. 191 nights in hotels last year. So
that's,
yeah,
I think I beat you just for like 2 days. That's a lot.
Right. It's a lot.
We're trying to trim that down this year for sure. My wife and I, for sure.
So if anybody wants to get a hold of you about getting classes in your area and stuff, just understand that, I mean, you got some focus on some other, you know, like we talked about them getting law enforcement training classes, but there are some competition classes. And if you want to try to have a range in a class that's out there, you have some opportunities, I think, on your schedule, but not a ton.
Yeah.
So if you get this in the next, you know, we're doing this on a Tuesday afternoon. It's February 1st. So it'll probably be posted by the end of this week. So just if anybody wants to know timeline, your schedule fills up pretty quickly.
It does. Fortunately, it's a crazy problem. It's good. My wife always says, like, man, you have more requests than you have time, which is really
right.
good. I mean, I've done something right, I guess. I don't know.
That is good. Well, when you have your call with Nicola, tell him I said hi.
I will.
That was a awesome visit that I got to go. That's in the current edition of the magazine.
That's awesome.
The Nationals is in this current edition of the magazine. You're on the cover.
I made the cover.
You made the cover. Yeah. When I sent that to you, you were like, man, it's been since like 2008 since I've been on the cover. And I was like, no, you were on there in 2018.
Yeah, 2018. I'm like, oh, that was so forgetful.
Yeah. I going and touring the plant and seeing everything they got going there and everything that they are backing you with and Jessica, your teammate with, and what they're planning on doing. I actually got to hold a couple of prototypes on some things that I can't talk about. But it's very cool to see Beretta bring you and Jessica and probably some other teammates and the history that they have in the shotgun world
yes.
to the competition pistol world, and some of what they have in Europe and IPSC, where they're a little bit more known on the handgun side of it, that they're bringing that to USPSA and they want to do it in kind of a big way. So it's been great to work with you guys and them. Anything else you want to cover?
Nothing. The Berettas has got a big vision of what they want to do in the pistol competition world. So that's
yes.
That's all I can say. Hope it happens.
Yes, they do. it would be great to see it come to light and to see another big name firearms manufacturer making guns dedicated to competition shooting, but that also cross over to their main line of guns. Yeah. That's been cool to watch. JJ, I can't thank you enough for joining us. We actually went, my normal time frame is an hour for these. We went an hour and 25 minutes. So
sorry,
but it was good. No, that's all right. It's all right. I think this was good. If anybody, wants to get on here, talk about anything, get a hold of you. You can follow him on his Instagram stories. You'll get a glimpse into his daily life. And then we'll see you at the range.
Yes,
thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Jake.
To find out more about USPSA and Steel Challenge, visit USPSA.org or SCSA.org. Download the USPSA and SCSA mobile apps available in your app store. Check out the NROI.org podcast available on your favorite podcast platform. All rights for this podcast are reserved. No portion of this podcast may be used or redistributed without written permission from the USPSA president. Rules and bylaw discussions on this podcast do not constitute official rulings or bylaw change. Discussions on this podcast are meant to inform and educate. If you have questions or want to reach out to your area director or USPSA office staff, visit uspsa.org/contact.